Whatever is in them is moving, I thought with a little thump of my heart. He set the boxes down, ran his hand through his hair. I'm meeting another falconer here in a bit. He's having the younger bird. Yours is the older. Bigger, too, he said. So. He ran his hand through his hair again, exposing a long talon scratch across his wrist, angry at its edges and scurfed with dried blood. We'll check the ring numbers against the Article 10s, he explained, pulling a sheaf of yellow paper from the rucksack and unfolding two of the official forms that accompany captive-bred rare birds throughout their lives. Don't want you going home with the wrong bird. We noted the numbers. We stared down at the boxes, at their parcel tape handles, their doors of thin plywood and hinges of carefully tied string. Then he knelt on the concrete, untied a hinge on the smaller box, and squinted into its dark interior. A sudden thump of feathered shoulders, and the box shook as if someone had punched it hard from within. She's got her hood off, he said, and frowned. That light leather hood was to keep the hawk from fearful sights, like us. Another hinge untied. Concentration, infinite caution, daylight irrigating the box. Scratching talons, another thump, and another thump. The air turned syrupy, slow, flecked with dust, the last few seconds before a battle, and with the last bow pulled free, he reached inside, and amidst a whirring, chaotic clatter of wings and feet and talons and a high-pitched twittering, and it's all happening at once, the man pulls an enormous, enormous hawk out of the box, and in a strange coincidence of world and deed, a great flood of sunlight drenches us, and everything is brilliance and fury. The hawk's wings barred and beating, the sharp fingers of her dark-tipped primaries cutting the air, her feathers raised like the scattered quills of a fretful porpentine, two enormous eyes. My heart jumps sideways. She's a conjuring trick, a reptile, a fallen angel, a griffin from the pages of an illuminated bestiary, something bright and distant like gold falling through water. A broken marionette of wings, legs, and light-splashed feathers. She's wearing jesses and the man holds them. For one awful, long moment, she's hanging head downward, wings open like a turkey in a butcher's shop, only her head is turned right way up, and she is seeing more than she has ever seen before in her whole short life. Her world was an aviary no larger than a living room, then it was a box. But now it is this, and she can see everything. The point source glitter on the waves, a diving cormorant 100 yards out, pigment flakes under wax on the lines of parked cars, far hills and the heather on them, and miles of sky, where the sun spreads on dust and water and illegible things moving in it that are white scraps of gulls. Everything is startling and new-stamped on her entirely astonished brain. Through all this, the man was perfectly calm. He gathered up the hawk in one practiced movement, folding her wings, anchoring her broad feathered back against his chest, gripping her scaled yellow legs in one hand. "Let's get that hood back on," he said tautly. There was concern in his face. It was born of care. This hawk had been hatched in an incubator, had broken from a frail bluish eggshell into a humid perspex box. And for the first few days of her life, this man had fed her with scraps of meat held in a pair of tweezers, waiting patiently for the lumpen, fluffy chick to notice the food and eat, her new neck wobbling with the effort of keeping her head in the air. All at once I loved this man, and fiercely. I grabbed the hood from the box and turned to the hawk. Her beak was open, her hackles raised, her wild eyes were the colour of sun on white paper, and they stared because the whole world had fallen into them at once. One, two, three. I tucked the hood over her head. There was a brief intimation of a thin, angular skull under her feathers, of an alien brain fizzing and fusing with terror. Then I drew the braces closed. We checked the ring numbers against the form. It was the wrong bird. This was the younger one, the smaller one. This was not my hawk. Oh. So we put her back and opened the other box, which was meant to hold the larger, older bird, and dear God it did. Everything about the second hawk was different. She came out like a Victorian melodrama, a sort of madwoman in the attack. She was smokier and darker and much, much bigger, and instead of twittering, she wailed, great awful gouts of sound like a thing in pain, and the sound was unbearable. This is my hawk, I was telling myself, and it was all I could do to breathe. She too was bareheaded, and I grabbed the hood from the box as before, but as I brought it up to her face, I looked in her eyes and saw something blank and crazy in her stare, some madness from a distant country. I didn't recognize her. This isn't my hawk. The hood was on, the ring numbers checked, the bird back in the box, the yellow form folded, the money exchanged, and all I could think was, but this isn't my hawk. Slow panic. I knew what I had to say, and it was a monstrous breach of etiquette. This is really awkward, I began. But I really like the first one. Do you think there's any chance I could take that one instead? I tailed off. His eyebrows were raised. I started again, saying stupider things. I'm sure the other falconer would like the larger bird. She's more beautiful than the first one, isn't she? I know this is out of order, but I... Could I? Would it be all right, do you think? And on, a desperate, crazy barrage of incoherent appeals. I'm sure nothing I said persuaded him more than the look on my face as I said it. A tall, white-faced woman with wind-wrecked hair and exhausted eyes was pleading with him on a quayside, hands held out, as if she were in a seaside production of Madea. Looking at me, he must have sensed that my stuttered request wasn't a simple one, that there was something behind it that was very important. There was a moment of total silence. All right, he said. And then, because he didn't see me believe him, yes. Yes, I'm sure that'll be okay. Chapter 6. The Box of Stars. Hiding to nothing, my old friend Martin Jones said, and he'd raised both hands in the air in a gesture half of supplication, half exasperation. It's like banging your head against a wall. Don't do it. It'll drive you mad. I kept thinking of what he'd said as I drove. Clutch into fourth gear, roundabout, change down. Fierce acceleration, slight resentment. I didn't want to think of all the things the men had told me. It'll drive you mad. Leave goshawks to the goshawk boys. Get something more sensible. I knew training this hawk would be hard. Goshawks are famously difficult to tame, to man in falconry parlance. You can man a merlin in a few days. I once flew a Harris hawk free after 4. But gosses are nervous, highly strung birds, and it takes a long time to convince them you're not the enemy. Nervousness, of course, isn't quite the right word. It's simply that they have jacked-up nervous systems, in which nerve pathways from the eyes and ears to the motor neurons that control their muscles have only minor links with associated neurons in the brain. Goshawks are nervous because they live life 10 times faster than we do, and they react to stimuli literally without thinking. Of all hawks, wrote 17th century falconer Richard Blome, she is doubtless the most shy and coy, both towards the men and dogs, requiring more the courtship of a mistress than the authority of a master, being apt to remember any unkind and rough usage, but being gently handled will become very tractable and kind to her keeper. Well, kindness it would be, and kindness we shall hope for. Kindness and love. I remember thinking idly as I drove about that fierce burst of love I'd felt on the quayside for a man who held a bird terrified by a world it couldn't comprehend. It took me miles of gentle puzzling before I worked out that the love was about my father and me. For weeks after he died, I'd sat in front of the television watching the British television drama Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy over and over again. Hours of grainy 1970s 60mm silly film, soft and black on an old VHS tape. I'd curled up mentally in its dark interiors, its Whitehall offices and gentlemen's clubs. It was a story of espionage and betrayal that fitted together like a watch, and it was glacially slow and beautiful. But it was also a story about a boy called Jumbo, a boarder at a second-rate prep school in the Quantock Hills. Jumbo was one of life's losers, plump, short-sighted, asthmatic. He suffered from a terrible sense of uselessness and all the guilt of a broken home. When a new French master arrived, a hunchbacked, piratical trap called Prido, Jumbo took him as an ally, someone who understood.
"You're a good watcher," Prido said. "I'll tell you that for nothing, old boy. Us singles always are."
What Jumbo didn't know, couldn't know, was that Prido had been a spy, and Prido's hurt back was a Russian bullet, and that there were other hurts too, for Prido had been betrayed by his friend and former lover. Jumbo's world was too small to encompass such things, but he sensed that his teacher had lost some great friend all the same, and took it upon himself to stand in for that friend until he returned. He had found a use for himself. Watching the video, I loved Prido, and his prep school landscape with hills buried in mist and rooks querulous in elms, rugger matches and white breath from the mouths of boys on fields on winter mornings, became the setting for a whole series of grief-spurred dreams that spring. What happens to the mind after bereavement makes no sense until later. Even as I watched, I'd half realized Prido was a figure I'd picked out for a father. But what I should have realized, too, on those northern roads is that what the mind does after losing one's father isn't just to pick new fathers from the world, but pick new selves to love them with. Back in those first few weeks, small and desperate, I'd chosen to be Jumbo. And on that Scottish quayside, just for a moment, without knowing why, I'd chosen to be the hawk. And I drove and drove, and the road slipped by, and the sky annealed into sloughs of the hardest white and blue. I started to fret. The box was far too quiet. I pulled gloomily into the next motorway services. Christina ran off to buy ice cream, and I squinted into one of the air holes punched in the box's cardboard sides. After hours of top-lit tarmac, my vision was in ruins. I couldn't see anything at all, and I didn't really want to, because, of course, the hawk was dead. And then, all at once, my God, the box was full of stars. A long time ago, I'd seen a suitcase in an art gallery. A small brown leather suitcase lying on its side on a white table. It was the most mundane object imaginable, and faintly sad, as if someone had put it down on their way somewhere and forgotten to pick it up. The artist had cut a small round hole through the leather. "Look inside," said a pasted label, and with the faint embarrassment of being required to participate in a work of art, I leaned and put my eye to the hole. Started in surprise, looked again, and there I was, a king of infinite space, dizzy, exhilarated, looking into a deep star field that stretched into infinity. It was cleverly done. The artist had stuck two acid-spotted mirrors to the top and bottom of the case and lit them with a parade of tiny bulbs. The reflections of the spots and holes in the glass and the bright points of light turned the interior of that suitcase into a bright, cold universe that went on forever. Crouched over the car's back seat and lost in the memory of the suitcase, I stared at a field of stars in darkness. Slowly, it resolved into specks of feather dust, little pieces of the crumbled keratin that protects growing feathers, loosed from the hawk's young plumage and lit by a shaft of stray sunlight from a crack in the top of the box. Eyes and brain fell into place, and now I could see a dull shine of half-light on one lemon-yellow taloned foot. Dim feathers, shivering with apprehension. The hawk knew she was being watched. I shivered too.
She's okay?
Asked Christina, back and biting into a Solero.
Fine, I said. Absolutely fine.
Engine on, we pulled away. Hawks had been traded for centuries, I chided myself.
Of course she was alive. 7 hours is nothing. Think of the 17th century falcon traders who brought wild hawks to the French court from as far away as India. Think of the 5th Earl of Bedford importing falcons from Nova Scotia and New England. Rows of perched hawks in wooden ships, hooded and still, and the lowing of cattle that were carried as cargo on those ships to feed them. And as we drove onward, I thought of White's goshawk, of how much worse its journey had been than this. First from its nest to a German falconer, then by aeroplane to England, then by train from Croydon to a falconer called Nesbitt in Shropshire, then to a different falconer in Scotland as part of a swap that didn't seem to come off, for the hawk was returned to Nesbitt. A few days' reprieve in an airy loft, and it was back on a train, this time to Buckingham, a small red-brick market town 5 miles from Stowe. And that is where White picked it up. How many miles? I reckon that's about 1,500 or so over many days. I'm not altogether sure how the hawk survived. Small souls sent far from safety. In the opening pages of The Goshawk, White describes the awful journey of his fledgling hawk, torn from its nest, stuffed in a basket, and sent to a strange land to receive an education. He asks us to imagine what it was like, to put ourselves in the hawk's bewildered infant mind, to experience the heat and noise, confusion and terror that was its journey to his door. "It must have been like death," he wrote, "the thing which we can never know beforehand." What we see in the lives of animals are lessons we've learned from the world. A while ago, in a yellow tin chest in a college library, I found some photographs of White as a toddler. They're silvered prints of a dusty Karachi landscape, a jandy tree, long shadows, a clear sky. In the first, the boy sits on a donkey looking at the camera. He wears a loose shalwar kameez and a child's sun hat, and his small round face has no interest in the donkey except for the fact that he is sitting on it. His mother stands behind him in impeccable Edwardian whites, looking beautiful and bored. In the second photograph, the boy runs towards the camera over parched earth. He is running as fast as he can. His stubby arms are blurred as they swing, and the expression on his face, half terror, half delight, is something I've never seen on any other child. It is triumph that he has ridden the donkey, but relief that it is over. It is a face in desperate need of safety, with certain knowledge that there is none. There was none. His parents' marriage was ill-starred from the first. Constance Aston had been nearly 30 when her mother's jibes about the cost of keeping her became unbearable. "I'll marry the next man who asks me," she snapped. The man was Garrick White, a district commissioner of police in Bombay. The newlyweds travelled to India, and as soon as Terence was born, Constance refused to sleep with her husband any more. He took to drink, and the marriage toppled into violence. 5 years later, the family came back to England to live for a while with Constance's parents in the South Coast resort of St. Leonard's-on-Sea. When they returned to India, they left the boy behind. It was an abandonment, but it was also a reprieve from fear. "All that time was too beautiful for these words," was how White described his St. Leonard's life in a faintly fictionalized autobiographical fragment
that in places breaks into his own childish voice, the voice of a small boy desperate for attention and already desirous of transformation into other, safer selves.
Look at me, Ruth. I'm a pirate chief. Look, I'm an aeroplane. Look, I'm a polar bear. Look, look, look.
There were puss moth caterpillars, a tortoise, a storeroom with chocolate and sugar in jars, and endless games with his cousins. But it could not go on forever. They took us away from that life, he wrote shortly, and sent us to schools. The idyll was over, the child pitched back into a life of fear and violence. His Cheltenham housemaster was a sadistic middle-aged bachelor with a gloomy, suffused face, and the prefects were his acolytes. They used to beat the younger boys after evening prayers. Every day the boy prayed, "Please, God, don't let me be beaten tonight." He usually was. "I knew in a dumb way it was a sexual outrage," he later mused, "though I could not have phrased that charge." No wonder he felt so deeply for the hawk. The boy had been torn from the only place he'd ever felt was home and sent away to be educated in a world of exacting, bureaucratic cruelty. It was a betrayal that marked White forever, and it would also mark his hawk. Ferox, fairy, free. Tim White sits at his kitchen table and fills his fountain pen from a bottle of green ink that stands on the oilskin tablecloth. The ink is a mischievous thing, a small, fierce thing. He is writing of his new life with a colour that is the ink of, what does Havelock Ellis call it? The favourite ink of inverts. The hawk arrives tomorrow. Soon there'll be three souls in the house, himself, his dog, his hawk. The thought thrills him. He loves this house. He calls it his workman's cottage, his badger's set, his refuge. Outside, light and leaf shadows move on the high grey gables. It is not a grand house. The water comes from a well and there is an earth closet in the garden, but he thinks it is a beautiful one. And yes, it is rented, costs him 5 shillings a week, but it is the first time he's ever lived in a place of his own. He is making it his. He's varnished the ceilings, painted everything bright. Red, glossy paint, blue robialac. On the mantelpiece, bird's wings, a spill jar, patterned wallpaper, a mirror, books everywhere. He spent £66 on deep pile carpets, bought a winged brocade armchair and laid in a stock of Madeira. Upstairs, he's transformed the guest bedroom into a fairy tale room of secret, romantic exuberance, mirrors and gilt, blue bed linen, and a golden bedspread surrounded by candles. Still, he can't bring himself to sleep in it. The camp bed in the other room with the brown curtains will suffice, and the hawk will live in the barn outside, and they will both call this place home. The Victorian terrace loomed and swayed in the summer dusk. I walked to my door, box in my arms. I don't remember opening the box that night. What I remember is my bare feet treading on carpet and the weight of the hawk on my fist. Her shape, long and haunted, and the hitch of her nervous shoulders as she stepped backwards onto the shadow of the bow perch on my living room floor. I remember thinking of the passage in The Sword in the Stone, where a falconer took a goshawk back onto his own fist, reassuming him, like a lame man putting on his accustomed wooden leg after it had been lost. Yes, holding the hawk for the first time felt like that, exactly like that. Mutely, I crawled up the stairs and fell into bed. The hawk was here, the journey was over. That night, I dreamed of my father. It wasn't the usual dream of a family reunited. In the dream, I'm searching for something in a house, an empty house with pale squares on the walls where pictures should be. I can't find what I'm looking for. I open an upstairs door onto a room that is not like the others. 3 white walls run with water, and the far wall is gone, No wall at all, just air falling into the pale violet of a city evening. Below me is a bombsite. Tons of bricks and rubble, rose bay willow herb blooming in drifts between broken rafters and spars that are ruined chairs, and the shadows between all these things are thickening to night. But they are not what I am looking at. Because standing on top of the tallest pile of bricks is a small boy with sandy hair. His face is turned away, but I recognize him immediately, and not just because he's wearing the same short trousers and lumpy grey jacket in a photograph in our family album. It is my father. As soon as I see him, I know where I am. This is Shepherd's Bush, where he'd run wild as a boy, clambering over bombsites with his friends, collecting things, salvaging them, hiding, watching. "We used to bomb bricks with bombs made of bricks," he told me once. "There wasn't much else to play with." And then the boy turns, looks up at me standing in the ruined house, and I know he's going to say something. But there are no words. Instead, he points with one arm, points up. I look. There's an aeroplane up there, thousands of feet above us, so high its fuselage and wings are still lit by the setting sun. There's no engine noise, no sound, nothing moving anywhere else. Just this small point of light crossing the sky until it passes over and is lost in the shadow of the world. And I look down again, and the boy that was my father is gone. Chapter 7. Invisibility. One interrogatory note, over and over again, like a telephone call from a bird deep in leaves. That's what pulled me from sleep. The noise came from a chaffinch in the lime tree outside my window, and I lay watching the day grow bright, listening to the sound move about in the tree behind the glass. It was a rain call, a beautiful name for a noise like an unanswered question. No one knows why chaffinches make it, but the name comes from an old tradition that it portends bad weather. In the 1950s, in a small research station in Madingley, a few miles north of where I lay, a scientist called Thorpe experimented on chaffinches to try to understand how they learned to sing. He reared young finches in total isolation in soundproofed cages and listened fascinated to the rudimentary songs his broken birds produced. There was a short window of time, he found, in which the isolated chicks needed to hear the elaborate trills of adult song, and if that window was missed, they could never quite manage to produce it themselves. He tried exposing his isolated fledglings to looped tapes of the songs of other species. Could they be persuaded to sing like tree pipits? It was a groundbreaking piece of research into developmental learning, but it was also a science soaked deep in Cold War anxieties. The questions Thorpe was asking were those of a post-war West obsessed with identity and frightened of brainwashing. How do you learn who you are? Can your allegiances be changed? Can you be trusted? What makes you a chaffinch? Where do you come from? Thorpe discovered that wild chaffinches from different places had different dialects. I listened carefully to the bird outside. Yes, its song was different from the song of Surrey chaffinches I'd learned as a child. It was thinner, less complicated, seemed to cut off before it was properly finished. I thought I would like to hear Surrey chaffinches again. I thought of sad birds in soundproofed cages and how your earliest experiences teach you who you are. I thought of the house from my dream. I thought of home. And then, with a slow, luxuriant thrill, I realized that everything was different about the house I was in. It was the hawk. I shut my eyes. The hawk had filled the house with wildness as a bowl of lilies fills a house with scent. It was about to begin. In the half-light, through the drawn curtains, she sits on her perch, relaxed, hooded, extraordinary. Formidable talons, wicked, curved black beak, sleek café au lait front streaked thickly with cocoa-coloured teardrops, looking for all the world like some cappuccino samurai. "Hello, Hawk," I whisper, and at the sound she draws her feathers tight in alarm. "Hush," I tell myself and the hawk. "Hush." Then I put on my falconer's glove, step forward and take her up onto my fist, untying the falconer's knot that secures her leash to the perch. She baits. Baiting. A headlong dive of rage and terror by which a leashed hawk leaps from the fist in a wild bid for freedom. That's how White described it in The Goshawk. The falconer's duty, he explained, is to lift the hawk back to the fist with his other hand in gentleness and patience. Her feet grip the glove convulsively. This perch is moving. I feel her mind grappling with novelty. But still, it is the only thing I understand. I shall hold it tight. I persuade her to step onto a perch on a modified set of scales. Hawks have a flying weight, just as boxers have a fighting weight. A hawk that's too fat, or high, has little interest in flying and won't return to the falconer's call. Hawks too low are awful things, spare, unhappy, lacking the energy to fly with fire and style. Taking the hawk back onto my fist, I feel for her breastbone with the bare fingers of my other hand. She is plump, her skin hot under her feathers, and through my fingertips I feel the beating of her nervous heart. I shiver, draw my hand back. Superstition. I can't bear to feel that flickering sign of life, can't help but suspect that my attention might somehow make it stop. In the front room I sit, tuck a piece of raw steak into the glove under her scaly feet, and wait. 1 minute. 2, 3, and I take the hood from her head. 2 wide, wild eyes stare at me for a fraction of a second and then they are gone. Before the hawk can work out what the hell is happening, she's trying to fly away as fast as possible. Brought up short by her jesses, she twitters in high-pitched distress as the realization of her hateful circumstances strikes. She can't get away. I lift her back onto the glove. Under her feathers is sinew and bone and that fast-beating heart. She baits again and again. I hate this. In these first few minutes, there's nothing you can do but accept that you are terrifying the hawk, when it is the very opposite of everything you desire. After 3 more baits, my heart is beating like a fitting beast, but she's back on the glove, beak open, eyes blazing. And then there is a long moment of extraordinary intensity. The goshawk is staring at me in mortal terror, and I can feel the silences between both our heartbeats coincide. Her eyes are luminous, silver in the gloom. Her beak is open. She breathes hot hawk breath in my face. It smells of pepper and musk and burned stone. Her feathers are half raised, and her wings half open, and her scaled yellow toes and curved black talons grip the glove tightly. It feels like I'm holding a flaming torch. I can feel the heat of her fear on my face. She stares. She stares and stares. Seconds slow and tick past. Her wings are dropped low. She crouches, ready for flight. I don't look at her. I mustn't. What I am doing is concentrating very hard on the process of not being there. Here's one thing I know from years of training hawks. One of the things you must learn to do is become invisible. It's what you do when a fresh hawk sits on your left fist with food beneath her feet in a state of savage defensive fear. Hawks aren't social animals like dogs or horses. They understand neither coercion nor punishment. The only way to tame them is through positive reinforcement with gifts of food. You want the hawk to eat the food you hold. It's the first step in reclaiming her that will end with you being hunting partners. But the space between the fear and the food is a vast, vast gulf, and you have to cross it together. I thought once that you did it by being infinitely patient. But no, it is more than that. You must become invisible. Imagine, you're in a darkened room. You're sitting with a hawk on your fist. She is as immobile, as tense and sprung as a catapult at full stretch. Underneath her huge thorny feet is a chunk of raw steak. You're trying to get her to look at the steak, not at you, because you know, though you haven't looked, that her eyes are fixed in horror at your profile. All you can hear is the wet click, click, click of her blinking. To cross this space between fear and food, and to somehow make possible an eventual concord between your currently paralyzed, immobile minds, you need, very urgently, not to be there. You empty your mind and become very still. You think of exactly nothing at all. The hawk becomes a strange, hollow concept, as flat as a snapshot or a schematic drawing, but at the same time as pertinent to your future as an angry high court judge. Your gloved fist squeezes the meat a fraction, and you feel the tiny imbalance of weight, and you see out of the very corner of your vision that she's looked down at it. And so, remaining invisible, you make the food the only thing in the room apart from the hawk. You're not there at all. And what you hope is that she'll start eating, and you can very, very slowly make yourself visible. Even if you don't move a muscle and just relax into a more normal frame of mind, the hawk knows. It's extraordinary. It takes a long time to be yourself in the presence of a new hawk. But I didn't have to learn how to do this. I was already an expert. It was a trick I'd learned early in my life, a small, slightly fearful girl, obsessed with birds, who loved to disappear. Like Jumbo in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, I was a watcher. I had always been a watcher. When I was a child, I'd climb the hill behind my house and crawl into my favourite den under a rhododendron bush, wriggling down on my tummy under overhanging leaves like a tiny sniper. And in this secret foxhole, nose an inch from the ground, breathing crushed bracken and acid soil, I'd look down on the world below, basking in the fierce calm that comes from being invisible, but seeing everything. Watching, not doing. Seeking safety in not being seen. It's a habit you can fall into, willing yourself into invisibility. And it doesn't serve you well in life. Believe me, it doesn't. Not with people and loves and hearts and homes and work. But for the first few days with a new hawk, making yourself disappear is the greatest skill in the world. The confidence with which I sat there with the hawk was absolute. I know how to do this, I thought. I am good, at least, at this. I know all the steps to this dance. First, the hawk will feed on my gloved fist. Then, as the days pass, she'll grow tamer, partly because I'm keeping her indoors and constantly in my presence, just as 15th century falconers had done. Soon she will step to my fist for food, and later she will jump to it. We'll go for long walks to accustom her to cars and dogs and people. And then she'll fly to me when I call her, first on a line, the creance, and then free. And then. I'd instructed my friends to leave me alone. I'd filled the freezer with hawk food and unplugged the phone. Now I was a hermit with a hawk in a darkened room, with books on three walls, a faded Afghan rug, and a sofa of stained yellow velvet. A mirror hung over the boarded-up fireplace, and a shell poster from the 1930s on the wall above me was reflected backwards and watery in the old glass. "You can be sure of shell," it said, along with a scumble of storm clouds and a part of the Dorset coast. There was an old television, a mint-green vinyl cloth on the floor with the hawk's perch on it, and a pair of deep green curtains printed with flowers that shut out the world. The goal was to be motionless, the mind empty, the heart full of hope. But as the minutes stretched, I had to move, just slightly, angle my foot to stop it sleeping, wrinkle my nose if it itched. And each time I did so, I felt the hawk flinch in fear. But I also saw, from the corner of my eye, that she was pulling herself up incrementally from that sprung-to-fly crouch. Her stance was more upright. There was a little less fear in the room. The old falconers called the manning of a hawk like this watching. It was a reassuringly familiar state of mind, meditative and careful and grave. For the first time in months, my life had a purpose. I was waiting for the moment from which all else follows, the hawk lowering her head and beginning to feed. That was all I wanted. That was all there was. Waiting. Watching. Sitting with the hawk felt as if I were holding my breath for hours with no effort. No rise, no fall, just my heart beating, and I could feel it in my fingertips, that little clipping throb of blood that, because it was the only thing I could sense moving, didn't feel part of myself at all, as if it was another person's heart or something else living inside me, something with a flat reptilian head, two heavy down-dropped wings, shadowed thrush-streaked sides. There was a greenish cast to the light in the room, dark and cool and faintly submarine. Outside, life went on, hot and distant. Shadows passed behind the curtains that were shoppers and students and bicycles and dogs. Vague, person-shaped shades making sounds like tin can telephones, blurred and incomprehensible. The slap-slap of walking feet, the hissing buzz of another bicycle. Long minutes passed. A piece of down, dislodged from the hawk's covert feathers, drifted slowly to the carpet at my feet. A tiny star, barely any quill to it, just a mass of soft white plumes. I looked at it for a long time. I'd not looked at an object like this with such searching attention with my mind elsewhere, since that reindeer moss, on the day the phone call came. White knuckle jobs, Dad used to call them. It was Fleet Street slang for the dangerous assignments. Leaning out of a helicopter with a camera in one hand and the other gripping the doorframe because the safety harness had snapped. Or looking through a fisheye lens from the top of Salisbury Cathedral, standing on a frail iron rung hammered into stone 400 feet in the sky. White knuckle jobs. I get through them by looking through the camera, he said. I bring it up like this, and he mimed holding it to his eye. Look through the viewfinder. It stops you being involved. It stops you being scared. You no longer possess a body to fall or fail. All that exists is a square of finely ground glass and the world seen through it, and a whole mass of technical decisions in your head about exposure and depth of field and getting the shot you hope for. Sitting there with the hawk in that darkened room, I felt safer than I'd done for months. Partly because I had a purpose, but also because I'd closed the door on the world outside. Now I could think of my father. I began to consider how he had coped with difficulty. Putting a lens between himself and the world was a defense against more than physical danger. It shielded him from other things he had to photograph. Awful things, tragic things, accidents, train crashes, the aftermath of city bombs. He'd worried that this survival strategy had become a habit. I see the world through a lens, he said once, a little sadly, as if the camera were always there, stopping him getting involved, something between him and the life that other people had. The chaffinch was calling again. How you learn what you are. Had I learned to be a watcher from my father? Was it a kind of childhood mimicking of his professional strategy for dealing with difficulty? I kicked the thought around for a while, and then I kicked it away. No, I thought, no. It was more, I can't think that, than, it's not true. all those thousands upon thousands of photographs my father had taken. Think of them instead. Each one a record, a testament, a bulwark against forgetting, against nothingness, against death. Look, this happened. A thing happened, and now it will never unhappen. Here it is in the photograph. A baby putting its tiny hand in the wrinkled palm of an octogenarian. A fox running across a woodland path, and a man raising a gun to shoot it. A car wreck, a plane crash, a comet smeared across the morning sky, a prime minister wiping his brow, the Beatles sitting at a cafe table on the Champs-Élysées on a cold January day in 1964, John Lennon's pale face under the brim of his fisherman's cap. All these things had happened, and my father had committed them to a memory that wasn't just his own, but the world's. My father's life wasn't about disappearance. His was a life that worked against it. He'd come home from work strangely disheartened one winter evening. We asked him what was wrong. "Did you see the sky today?" he said. He'd been walking through a London park on his way back from a press call. It was deserted, but for a small boy playing by a frozen boating lake. I said, "Look up, look at that. Remember you saw that? You'll never see it again." Above them both was a vast tracery of ice rings and sun dogs in a wintry, hazy sky. A 22-degree halo, a circumzenithal arc, and an upper tangent arc, the sun's light refracting and cutting the heavens into a complicated geometry of ice and air and fire. But the boy didn't seem interested at all. Dad was baffled. "Maybe he thought you were one of those strange men," we sniggered, rolling our eyes, and he looked embarrassed and faintly cross. But he was so very sad about the boy who didn't see. Now that Dad was gone, I was starting to see how mortality was bound up in things like that cold, arc-lit sky, how the world is full of signs and wonders that come and go, and if you are lucky, you might see them. Once, twice, perhaps never again. The albums on my mother's shelves are full of family photographs, but also other things. A starling with a crooked beak, a day of hoarfrost and smoke, a cherry tree thick with blossom, thunderclouds, lightning strikes, comets and eclipses, celestial events terrifying in their blind distances, but reassuring you too that the world is forever, though you are only a blink in its course. Henri Cartier-Bresson called the taking of a good photograph a decisive moment. Your eye must see a composition or an expression that life itself offers you, and you must know with intuition when to click the camera, he said. The moment. Once you miss it, it is gone forever. I thought of one of these moments as I sat there waiting for the hawk to eat from my hand. It was a black and white photograph my father had taken many years ago of an elderly street cleaner with a white goatee beard, wrinkled socks, and down-at-heel shoes, crumpled work trousers, work gloves, a woolen beret. The camera is low on the pavement. Dad must have crouched in the road to take it. The man is bending down, his besom of birch twigs propped against his side. He has taken off one of his gloves, and between the thumb and first finger of his bare right hand, he is offering a crumb of bread to a sparrow on the curbstone. The sparrow is caught mid-hop, at exactly the moment it takes the crumb from his fingers, and the expression on the man's face is suffused with joy. He is wearing the face of an angel. Time passed. Hawks gorge themselves in the wild and can spend days without food. I knew the hawk would not eat from my hand today. She was scared. She wasn't hungry. The world was an insult. Both of us needed a break. I popped the hood back over her head. There. Fleeting panic, nerves afire, and then she relaxed because the day had turned to night and I had disappeared. Hoodwinked. It was an ancient piece of trickery and an excusable one. The darkness would give her space to set her frayed nerves to rights, as would it mine. On her perch, she slept. I slept too, wrapped in a duvet dragged over the sofa. Later, when I picked her up again, the mood in the room had changed. She had done this before, was no longer entirely certain I was a monster. She baited once towards the floor, but it was a bait to the floor, not away from me in blind terror. I lifted her back onto the glove. We sat some more. Then, instead of fixing her gaze on me in horror, she began to examine her surroundings. New things, shelves, walls, floor. She inspected them all carefully with small sideways movements of her head, hawk parallax, judging perfect distances. She observed the ceiling as far as it would go, the lines of the bookshelves beneath it, cocked her head to consider the strip of messy tassels along the edge of the rug. Then came a decisive moment. It was not the one I was hoping for, but it was thrilling all the same. Regarding the room with simple curiosity, she turned her head and saw me, and jumped. Jumped exactly like a human in surprise. I felt the scratch of her talons, and her shock, too, cold and electric. That was the moment. Until a minute ago, I was so terrifying I was all that existed. But then she had forgotten me, only for a fraction of a second. But it was enough. The forgetting was delightful because it was a sign that the hawk was starting to accept me. But there was a deeper, darker thrill. It was that I had been forgotten. Chapter 8. The Rembrandt Interior. White loosed his young male goshawk in the barn that first night, and in the early hours at 3:05, it stepped onto his fist and fed. It was hungry, familiar with humans, willing already to come to the Falconer for food. It was a state that my hawk had not yet reached and would not reach for days. If White had only known what he was doing, Goss could have been flying free in a week. But he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't understand that a hawk in training must be kept a little hungry, for only through gifts of food would a wild bird begin to see you as a benevolent figure and not an affront to all existence. White was petrified. On his hawk's tail were strange, pale transverse stripes, as if someone had drawn a razor blade across the quills. He knew what they were, hunger traces caused by lack of food as the feathers grew, weaknesses that made them liable to break. Guilt and blame. He worried that it was his fault the hawk was damaged. He wanted to stop these hunger traces, make up for whatever early lack had scarred his hawk and made its feathers weak. So he fed it. He fed it as much as he possibly could. He didn't know that because those feathers were now full grown, there was no danger of making the traces worse. He gave the hawk so much food that the hawk couldn't eat it, bear the sight of it. And here is White, the terrified Ostringer, stroking the hawk's breast feathers with a split rabbit skull showing all the rabbit's spilled brains in desperate attempts to get it to eat, when the hawk doesn't want to eat because it is full. "Love me," he is saying. "Please. I can make it up to you, make it better, fix you. Please eat." But a fat, stuffed goshawk doesn't want anything other than to be left alone, to disappear into that half-world of no humans, replete and contented, eyes half-closed, one foot tucked up into soft feathers to digest its food and sleep. Over the coming days and weeks, White tries different food, better food, trying to tempt the hawk to eat more than it can bear. He is wheedling, desperate, certain that his patience will triumph. And of course, at some point, the hawk becomes half hungry enough to eat, and White stuffs it with food, convinced that all will now be well. And then the hawk hates him, and the strange cycle begins again. Days of attack and counterattack, was how White described it, a kind of sweeping to and fro across disputed battlefields. There is a nightmarish logic to White's time with the hawk. the logic of a sadist who half hates his hawk because he hates himself, who wants to hurt it because he loves it but will not, and insists that it eats so that it will love him. And these twisted logics were met with the simple logic of a wild, fat goshawk that considers this man the most inimical thing on earth. "I had only just escaped from humanity," White wrote, "and the poor goss had only just been caught by it." But he hadn't escaped, not quite. When you read The Goshawk, you're given to understand that his cottage was miles from anywhere, a remote outpost deep in a wood half a mile from the nearest road. But the cottage was on the Stowe estate. It had been built on one of the old roads laid out as carriage routes to the great house centuries before. They were called the Ridings, and one ran in a shifting river of grass straight past White's cottage, over the crest of a sheep-cropped hill and down to the doors of the school. The house was rustic, yes. It had an earth closet and a well, and when White stood with his hawk in the barn, he could still see where a Victorian gamekeeper had written of vanished bags of game in pencil on the back of the door. Pheasant, it said. Hern. But remote it was not. There was his house, not quite in a wood, sitting on the old and open road to Stowe, like a promise not quite kept, and White in it, like a dog who sits at the very end of his chain, or the sad divorcee who moves out of their partner's house to live at the bottom of the road. For all his joy and freedom, the schoolmaster had not escaped the bounds of the school, and he'd not escaped schoolmastering either. In Blaine's book, White read that falconry was the art of control over the wildest and proudest of living creatures, and that to train them the falconer must battle their defiance and rebellious attitude. The training of the hawk mirrored the education of the public schoolboy. In both, a wild and unruly subject was shaped and moulded, made civilized, was taught good manners and obedience. But the methods were different, and this gave White much pleasure. "I had been a schoolmaster for so long," he wrote, "in which profession the standard way of meeting a difficult situation was by punishment. It was nice after this to discover a profession of education where punishment was treated as ridiculous." It was the perfect kind of education, he decided, for him and for the hawk. He would call his book The Ostringer, and in its pages he and his readers would take a patient excursion into the fields and back into the past. That excursion wasn't just back into an imagined English past. It was also a journey back into his own. White had dropped out of the curious adult heterosexual competition, had become again a monastic boy. In those long hours of psychoanalysis with Bennett, White had learned that going back in time was a way of fixing things, uncovering past traumas, revisiting them and diffusing their power. Now he was going back in time with the hawk. He'd already empathized with the fledgling in the basket, seen the hawk as himself. Now he was unconsciously reenacting his childhood, with the hawk standing in for himself as a boy, and the grown-up White playing the role of an enlightened teacher who could not, would not, must not beat or hurt the child in his care. He considers falconry the most glorious of mysteries. He has no one to teach him and two books to learn from, not counting the description in the Encyclopaedia Britannica, which he has almost by heart. There is Blaine's Falconry, published the previous year, and Coursing and Falconry by Gerald Lascelles from 1892. But the book White cleaves to is much older. It was published in 1619. Called An Approved Treatise of Hawks and Hawking, it is all about goshawks, and it was written by Edmund Burt, gentleman. White didn't yet possess a copy of his own, for it was a rare volume, but he'd read it. Perhaps he'd read the copy kept at the Cambridge University Library. Perhaps it was the very same copy I'd pored over as a student. As White was seduced by Burt's book, so was I. It is bloody marvellous.
Bert is the 17th century counterpart of some of the blunter Yorkshire goshawkers of my acquaintance on whom something of the hawk's character has rubbed off. Accomplished, cantankerous, with a bracing wit, he never fails to arrogate himself, tell us how perfectly his hawks behave, craning on tiptoe to pick marrow from his fingertips. They are happy to travel with him where